Please pray with me. Holy God, who speaks peace to every heart, descend upon us now. I ask that, whether through my words or in spite of them, your word and your peace may be proclaimed in each of us. Amen. As you may know, the pastoral team is planning a bit of a shakeup in adult education starting in the new year. Pastor Roni has been teaching a class on Revelation in Spanish, and in January, he will then switch to teaching it in English. And then I will be collaborating with Olga Diaz, a member of the Hispanic congregation who has taught Sunday school for many years. We will be continuing the study of Revelation in Spanish. So Olga, Roni, and I met last week to prepare for these two classes. And we were going over texts and planning a structure. And then Olga stopped and said, "You know, this is going to be a challenge for me, because I grew up Pentecostal, and it was a very rigid tradition, very black and white. And I've learned over the years to deepen and broaden my understanding of how the biblical text can come across in our lives, what it can mean, what it can signify. But Revelation is sort of ground zero for literal interpretations. These texts, for her, were the most rigidly interpreted of all, and therefore the hardest to come back to." I responded that it was going to be a challenge for me too, but for very different reasons. I didn't grow up with those texts. I don't think I ever heard a sermon preached on the second coming or Revelation or the end times. It was not discussed. I grew up in a progressive Baptist context in Madison, Wisconsin. My parents, though, had grown up Southern Baptists. And like many moderate to progressive Southern Baptist folk, they had, and they still have, a fierce pride in their Baptist identity, in their Baptist heritage. But after the Southern Baptist Convention was taken over by fundamentalists in the early 80s and drove out anyone who was not fundamentalist, there was a lingering resentment, a bitterness, a sense that something about their faith had been stolen from them. So I grew up with both of these coming from my parents, both that fierce pride in being Baptist, but also that sense that something had been taken from this Baptist tradition, this Christian identity that they had. So growing up with this legacy, as I became a young adult and as I began to embark on pursuing a vocation, a religious vocation as a minister, I started to search for what it was that had been taken. What was it that had been lost in this tradition I had grown up with? What was it that the more progressive side had seeded in that particular struggle of the Southern Baptist Convention and the broader culture war that surrounded it and that still surrounds it? And I think texts about the end times, texts about the second coming of Christ, the texts we read at this time of year, during Advent, were one of those things that I had lost. The progressive Christian community I grew up in didn't seem to want to have much to do with this aspect of Christian traditions. We even wanted to distance ourselves from it a bit. And there were good reasons for that. I and the community that surrounded me saw the second coming of Jesus being used to deny responsibility for striving to heal the world, to deny responsibility for the human impact on the environment, because Jesus was coming soon anyway, so what did it really matter? We saw apocalyptic texts used to justify actions that did not serve the cause of peace and human well-being, based on the notion that those actions might hasten the arrival of Jesus, a belief that is at best problematic and at worst heresy. We saw these texts from Revelation used to inspire fear and to condemn people to damnation because of what they believed, because of who they loved, because there was something inside them, some prophetic seed that defied the dominant culture. End times theology was and continues to be used to inspire fear of damnation that chokes out holy and defiant seeds that God has planted in our hearts. I didn't want to be anywhere near that. I still don't. And yet, aside from the irresponsible and abusive ways I saw end times theology being used, there was something attractive about it. There was something compelling about these images from Revelation. And at the same time, they completely defied my sense of reason, any logic that my brain could come up with. Take Revelation 15. It reads, "Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last, and with them the wrath of God is finished. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, and also those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name, standing beside the sea of glass with the harps of God in their hands." That text is as powerful and stunning as it is mind-blowingly incomprehensible. I don't presume to be rational and logical in all things. I think that would be unforgivably boring and dull. But what am I supposed to do with this? A sea of glass mingled with fire? The number of a name? How does a name have a number? Yet, as I said, there's something so undeniably compelling about this vision, these visions of that which is to come, a reign brought about by God in which justice, true justice, reigns. And in a way, it is fitting that that vision is incomprehensible, because we've never seen it, not truly in this world. We don't see true peace and justice except in brief flashes. Though we may, and though we must strive to build a world that is better, the fullness of God's dream is always beyond us, which is another way of saying we will never fully arrive there in our own lives. Over the past 2.5 years, I have been blessed to share a part of the journey with the people in this room. I know that you go out from here every week, and you go into schools to provide loving support and guidance for students against whom every card seems to be stacked. You strive to create opportunities for relationships to grow where there was previously distance and misunderstanding and stereotypes. You work to heal the most wounded minds and bodies. You are students striving to follow your dreams and figure out where you belong in a world that is strange and constantly changing. You are parents striving to support those students in a world that you don't fully understand and might even be somewhat afraid of. You are prophets who decry injustice against communities whose rights have too long been overlooked. And for all of you, every day, there is more work to do. No relationship fully heals all wounds. No plan of action cures all woes. Which is perhaps why I find myself compelled to lift my eyes to a vision of justice that defies my understanding. A vision that also lives in this text that we read today. It's not an apocalyptic text, per se, but it is no less about the future redemption of the world. The text says, "Kindness and truth will meet, justice and peace will kiss." In the text that Viola read, it said, "Righteousness and peace will kiss." In Hebrew, in Greek, and in fact in many languages, the word justice and righteousness is the same word. The text says, "Truth from the earth will spring up as justice from heaven rains down. and the Lord will grant bounty, and our land will grant its yield. Justice will go before God. In fact, justice will be the path upon which God walks among us. This psalm, this oracle, imagines a future time of redemption in which we are returned to Eden before the fall. And don't let the beautiful poetry fool you. This text is no less radical than that sea of glass mixed with fire. Many early theologians envisioned the fall as a tearing apart of the perfect unity of God, where people fell into division and created distance among themselves, between themselves and nature, between themselves and God. All of creation was torn apart in the fall. All of the cosmos were ripped apart in the fall. And this psalm imagines redemption as a coming back together, a healing of those divisions, justice coming down from heaven and truth coming up from the earth, righteousness and peace, kissing, removing whatever barrier it had been that had kept them apart, and coming together in this most intimate gesture. This psalmist's vision is both cosmic and intimate. Truth and peace, justice and peace, kiss. In this coming together, this grand family reunion of peace and truth and justice and kindness, the natural world is restored. It bears life. It bears fruit. It is abundant, like that garden of Eden. And after all of this, after truth and peace come together, after the land yields its fruit, God again walks on the earth, on a path made of justice, just as God had walked in the Garden of Eden. This joyous reunion of the Creator and the created in a paradise made manifest here. Not, as the song says, in some heaven light years away, but in the present moment, in our time, on this earth. What is perhaps most remarkable about this vision is it pours forth from the lips of one sitting in darkness and crying out for rescue, like so many after, who found comfort and even founded their very survival on a vision of the reign of God descending to earth to bring its final justice. So do I believe that a day will come when the clouds break and Jesus descends? When justice rains down from the sky and truth rises from the earth, when the lion lays down with the lamb. I don't know. The vision of that day defies the limits of my mind and every logic it contains. But even so, I long for it. I long for it. The theologian John Caputo once wrote that being religious is to be impassioned by the impossible. It is an alliance toward the hoping, sighing, dreaming over the arrival of something wholly other, the calling upon and being called by something to come, the anticipation and the expectation of that which lies before us, though not always quite certain what it is, only that it will come. Hoping, sighing, and dreaming. They go together. I long for a day when the mighty are brought low and the humble exalted. I long for a day when justice and peace kiss, the land is healed and yields its abundant harvest. When, as we are about to sing, God's justice tears every tyrant from their throne and the hungry poor weep no more. I long for the arrival of a justice that exceeds every logic of my mind and every logic of this world, and for a peace that truly and utterly surpasses my understanding. And that longing, in the end, has proved more enduring than belief. It is the central thread that pulls me toward God. Longing is like hoping. It calls us toward a future that is always slightly beyond our reach. Longing is like hoping, keeping our eyes focused on a vision of heaven and pulling us toward it by hook or by crook. Longing is like hoping with an anguished heart. A heart that is weary of long nights and heavy with a thousand griefs, full of the pain of this world. I long for the reign of God to come. So as we have been asking, where is peace? Where in the midst of the journey towards this most impossible of visions do we find the peace of this candle that we light today? Last week, David told the children that hope is like a river pulling us toward God and toward God's dream for us. If hope is the river, or even if longing is the river, I think peace is the rocking of the boat, that holy restlessness that Sherry mentioned, the steady movement of a heart and a people drawn inexorably, impossibly, toward a reign of love and justice that is always just beyond the horizon. This Advent, may we hope for a future that we can scarcely imagine. And as we journey onward, may we feel its peace. Amen.